This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can't really understand how Iran, North Korea, and Libya developed their nuclear weapons programs without understanding the work of A.Q. Khan. He's considered the father of Pakistan's nuclear bomb. He headed that country's nuclear weapons program for 25 years, starting in 1976. While developing clandestine methods of obtaining information and materials to build a nuclear weapon, he also developed a clandestine network for selling information and technology to other countries trying to build nuclear weapons. A.Q. Khan was arrested last year and, after making a confession, received a conditional pardon from Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf. Khan is now under house arrest. My guest, David Albright, has been following Khan's story for about 20 years. Albright is the president of the Institute for Science and International Security and worked as a U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq. What has A.Q. Khan confessed to?
A.Q. Khan has confessed to helping Iran, North Korea, and Libya acquire gas centrifuges. In the case of Libya, nuclear weapons design. In essence, he's confessed that he was really at the center of this illicit network that was transferring sensitive nuclear technology and actual centrifuges to Iran, North Korea, and Libya.
So what are some of the things he's suspected of having done that he hasn't confessed to?
Well, one is, did he provide Iran and North Korea with secret designs and manufacturing instructions for nuclear weapons? And the type of nuclear weapons assistance that Khan offered to Libya would be extremely useful to North Korea and Iran so that they could miniaturize their nuclear weapon and fit it on their existing missiles, like the Nodong in North Korea and the Shahid 3 in Iran.
So how would you say that A.Q. Khan and his network have thus far affected the state of nuclear proliferation in the world?
Well, they've scared everybody. I mean, it's the thing you always worry about most is that a country will get a shortcut to nuclear weapons. I mean, that's why people worried so much about the security of stocks of plutonium and highly enriched uranium in Russia. I mean, it represents a tremendous shortcut to nuclear weapons. And what Khan has done is, in essence, given some of our worst enemies the wherewithal to make nuclear weapons. And now Libya is out of the picture, thank God, and we don't worry about Libya. But it could be that we have a military conflict with Iran or North Korea where they would have nuclear weapons because of the assistance from A.Q. Khan. And so I think if you look at the damage that Khan's done, you really do have to think of him in the same way we think of Osama bin Laden.
After A.Q. Khan made his confession, he was given by President Musharraf of Pakistan, he was given a conditional pardon and sentenced to house arrest. And President Musharraf called A.Q. Khan, quote, my hero. He said, I revere him for his contribution to making the defense of the country impregnable. Why is A.Q. Khan, who helped these other countries get nuclear weapons, why is he a hero to the president of Pakistan?
Well, first of all, the Khan network was created by Khan and his associates to get the wherewithal to make nuclear weapons for Pakistan. And they wanted to use the stolen gas centrifuge design information that Khan had acquired in the Netherlands. And they needed to create an illicit procurement network to buy all kinds of materials, machine tools, other technology, principally from Europe. And so they set up a smuggling network back in the 1970s and early 80s that was quite remarkable in getting all the items they needed. Then in the mid-80s, they started to think about selling to others. And so their first sale to Iran was in 1987. But first and foremost, the Khan network is a network created by the Khan in full cooperation with the Pakistani government to, in a sense, arm Pakistan and give it nuclear weapons. And so he's a hero because of that. And the fact that he broke laws all over the world, that Pakistani government was lying all the time about Khan's activities because the government would be regularly confronted about Khan and his associates buying things illegally for Pakistan, shed some light on, unfortunately, to the culture of the Pakistani government, and that it's a culture where lying historically has been accepted as a norm in order to get nuclear weapons. And that's part of the reason why people don't trust that the Khan and the Pakistani government have told the full story about all the activities of Khan in providing dangerous items to other countries.
So President Musharraf gave AQ Khan a conditional pardon and sentenced him to house arrest. That seems like a very lenient sentence for somebody who sold nuclear secrets to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. Why such a lenient sentence?
He is a hero. And I think that Musharraf calculated, and I disagree with this, that if he imprisoned AQ Khan, he could have major dissent from within the army or within the population of Pakistan. And so I think he decided not to go very far with Khan for fear of the reaction within Pakistan. Now, I think you can say, okay, perhaps pardon Khan if he fully confesses, but it doesn't answer why none of the other Pakistanis have been brought to justice. I mean, there's at least 10 that we know of that have been arrested and questioned. I mean, there may be one who's still in jail. And so it's not only Khan has not received any punishment, none of them have.
Well, some people have speculated that one of the reasons why President Musharraf gave such a light sentence to AQ Khan was that the government and the intelligence agencies in Pakistan knew some of the illegal things that Khan was doing, and they're protecting themselves. What do you think of that theory?
I think there is some truth to that. In fact, before Khan was arrested, I mean, he knew the writing was on the wall. I mean, the United States had officials had been there to tell him that a lot of information was coming out. They better do something about Khan. Khan was talking to reporters, and those stories were being printed where Khan was more or less sending signals. There's others involved. I mean, particularly in North Korea, maybe there was government to government arrangements on North Korea. And so I think that Khan was in a position to make a deal with the Pakistani government that I'll take all the blame and I won't implicate anybody else in the government, particularly above me or had retired from office, but I don't want any serious punishments. So I think there's certainly some truth to that. It's hard to prove, certainly. And the Pakistani government denies it. Now, of course, Khan denies it. But I do think that it's one of the reasons why Khan was not punished. And he may have also in that negotiation said, "Don't punish my associates too." And that would explain or partially explain why they have not suffered any jail time.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about AQ Khan. He was the father of Pakistan's nuclear bomb program, and he confessed last year to having sold nuclear secrets and technology to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. He's now under house arrest in Pakistan. My guest, David Albright, is president of the Institute for Science and International Security. He's been tracking Khan for about 20 years. What are the odds that although AQ Khan is now under house arrest, that his network is still functioning?
Well, it's a big concern. I certainly many of the members of the network have been arrested. I mean, there's been arrests in South Africa, Germany, Switzerland, Netherlands. People are being investigated in Britain, Dubai. So there's a lot of them have been identified. But you worry that not everybody's been identified, and you worry about sort of the kernel of this of the Khan network, which is the secret drawings, manufacturing instructions, much of which is digital now, that could be hidden and used by someone else to recreate this network later on. And so you do worry that out of the remnants of the network, a new one could arise that will have to chase down or suffer the consequences of in the future. And that's why it's so important to be thorough now on the investigations to try to get to the bottom of what was the Khan network, who was involved, and what exactly did they do. And then what's happened to all their secret drawings, the things they made. I mean, there's still questions about some of the items that the Khan network was making for Libya. I mean, not all those items have been accounted for. And so where are they? There's also real questions about, were there other customers? We know in the case of Iraq, Khan says that Iraq was offered and they didn't accept. I mean, the actual story is in 1990, in the fall, after the invasion of Kuwait, but prior to the Allied attack on Iraq, Khan's intermediary went to Baghdad and said, look, we'll help you build nuclear weapons. We'll help you with gas centrifuges. You know, and it's, you know, here's what we can do. Here's the price. The Iraqis were actually suspicious. They wondered if Pakistan or this Pakistani was working with the United States government. It was a sting operation. But nonetheless, what Khan was offering, particularly on nuclear weapons design, was attractive to the Iraqis. They were having a lot of trouble then miniaturizing their nuclear warhead. They had a lot of trouble, in fact, learning how to build a nuclear weapon. There's a lot of complicated things that go into that if it's going to work properly and reliably. So what the Iraqis did in the end is they asked for a sample of the wares. They didn't turn it down. They asked for a sample of the wares, but within about 2 or 3 months, the bombing campaign started and the whole thing became moot. So I think the concern is that, well, A.Q. Khan says no assistance was given to Iraq, that wasn't the whole story. That if Iraq had had more time, it may have pursued the assistance on nuclear weapons. And so questions come up, what happened exactly with Syria? What's happened with Al-Qaeda? And are there other countries? Saudi Arabia comes up quite often. Was there some kind of arrangement with Saudi Arabia? One of the ironic customers of the Khan network, or at least members of the Khan network, was India. That we now know that a very important member of the Khan network in South Africa sold to India's gas centrifuge program. I mean,
wait a minute. That makes no sense to me because the primary reason why Khan wanted Pakistan to have a nuclear weapon is to defend itself against India.
That's right. So it's certainly ironic, and it shows you that for much of the network, money was the motive, and they would sell almost to anybody. And so now we don't think India got the gas centrifuge designs. I mean, I don't think they got the kinds of things that Khan would have controlled. So I think Khan would have himself probably taken a very dim view on providing gas centrifuge technology to India, but members of his network didn't view that as sufficient to keep them from selling things, dual-use items, or in some cases, direct-use items to India's gas centrifuge program.
Besides money, did Khan have other motivations? Did he have any political or religious motivations to sell nuclear technology to other countries?
I think he did. I mean, one of the first cases I had to look at back in the late 1980s, early 90s, was Khan's publishing of what would be considered secret gas centrifuge information in Western journals. And in those journals, at least in one case, he talked about, you know, the sort of hostility to the West and their so-called secrecy. And so I think over time, I saw that he had this contempt of Western export controls, a feeling that he was going to give this information away despite U.S. efforts and Western European efforts to keep it secret. Also, if you look at his customers, you can't help but think that he tended to favor Islamic states and that there was some kind of Islamic flavor to his assistance. I mean, other than North Korea, the only cases we know of where he was directly involved are Islamic states.
How was A.Q. Khan busted?
Oh, the whole story has not been made public. I mean, we're hoping George Tenet will write a book and reveal a lot more. I mean, it's a very exciting story where the CIA was able to, or the British intelligence were able to. I would imagine through perhaps communication intercepts, kind of get a real sense of what Khan was selling, that he wasn't just buying, but he was also selling. And what people were looking for was really strong evidence. I mean, there was all kinds of indirect evidence this was taking place. Some of it goes back to the late 1980s, particularly with Iran. There were strong suspicions or even evidence that Khan was selling gas centrifuge technology to Iran. But people were looking for really concrete evidence. And part of the reason for that was if you confronted the Pakistani government, they would just vehemently deny that any of it was true and just blindly defend Khan. And so the idea was to get very good evidence. And then whatever evidence they got around 2000, they decided that it made sense to hold back and penetrate the network rather than use that evidence to confront the Pakistani government or try to bust up the network. For a couple of years, the intelligence agencies in Britain and the United States penetrated this network, developed evidence of at least a portion of the network. And then at some point, actually the point was more or less decided, they were getting nervous about how far Libya was getting toward getting nuclear weapons. They decided to bust up the network. And one of the more dramatic aspects of that was the seizure of the BBC China, a ship on its a German-registered ship, I believe, that was going from Dubai to Libya. And they intercepted it, and it was taken to an Italian port, and they seized centrifuge components that had been made in Malaysia for the Libyan gas centrifuge program. And then after that, there was a series of arrests as the investigation gained steam.
Do you think that Al-Qaeda or any other terrorist group has a nuclear device now, with or without the help of AQ Khan?
There's no evidence of it. I mean, you know, you don't know what you don't know. I mean, but again, I think one of the lessons of the Iraqi WMD, you just call it fiasco, is that we shouldn't rush to worst-case analysis and just assume, well, there must be some fissile material missing, some plutonium or highly enriched uranium, and maybe it's in the hands of terrorists. So I think there's no indications that I know of that any terrorist group has any nuclear explosive material or a nuclear weapon. I mean, there's been many media reports to that effect, but when we've chased them down, they haven't been substantiated. But the fact that you can't eliminate the possibility that there's some plutonium or highly enriched uranium missing, I think the CIA in assessments has stated that to Congress, makes you worried that we need to put a lot of energy into trying to secure all the fissile material in the world and drastically reduce the chance that some of it could go missing.
So what's your best guess about the state of the nuclear weapons program in Iran and North Korea?
Well, they're different. I mean, North Korea has nuclear weapons, and for a couple of years they've been, or at least over a year, they've been saying they have nuclear weapons. They've used the term nuclear deterrent, but they've talked about it in terms of we're improving the number and quality of our nuclear deterrent. They recently have shifted over to just calling them nuclear weapons, or in the initial release they called them nukes. In some ways, they've been talking to Americans too much, and they picked up our lingo. But they do have nuclear weapons. We don't know unfortunately, we don't know the quality, and we don't know the number. I mean, it can't be more than a 7, 8, 9 nuclear weapons, we don't know if they can miniaturize to put them on their missiles in a way that they trust they'll work. But we do fear that they've learned to put a warhead on at least a Nodong missile that could reach Japan. And now the question is, will they increase the number, or will they settle down into some negotiations where they'd give up all these nuclear weapons? We just don't know at this time. I mean, things right now don't look very good. In the case of Iran, they don't have nuclear weapons. I mean, we think they've been involved in operations to try to buy nuclear weapons in the former Soviet Union. A very senior CIA person told me a couple years ago that Iran actually thought it was buying nuclear weapons, paid a lot of money, and got scammed. So, and that's been a case that was received a lot of publicity back in the early 90s. But Iran is mostly concentrating on trying to build indigenous facilities. And this is where it used the Khan Network's assistance to help it get over some very important bumps in the road on building a gas centrifuge plant. And in fact, without the Khan assistance, I don't think they could have gotten over those bumps. I think they would have been stopped, at least for decades, based on the Iranian scientific capabilities and the rate that they make progress at. And more importantly, Iran has agreed to suspend its enrichment program. So it's negotiating what they call long-term arrangements with the EU, European Union, principally Germany, France, and Britain, And those negotiations aren't going very well right now because in the end, Iran says we want to have a gas centrifuge program. We want to enrich uranium. It's our right under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Europeans are saying, well, look, if you don't end this program permanently, you're not going to have good relations with us. And hardly a day goes by where Iran isn't threatening to end those negotiations if they don't get the agreement of the European Union to continue their enrichment program. So it's, again, it's a situation that isn't going that well, and we're just waiting to see how it develops.
What are some of the most effective carrots or sticks you think the United States could use now in trying to convince Iran to stop its nuclear weapons program?
Well, there are two things that the United States needs to do. One is it needs to, and it started this process, work with the European Union. Just say, look, your approach, Germany, France, and Britain, is a reasonable one. And it may convince Iran to give up these dangerous nuclear technologies. Unfortunately, when Iran looks at any deal with the European Union, it wants to know that if it gives up these nuclear capabilities, that it's getting back some kind of security guarantee from the United States that it's not going to be attacked or that the United States won't have a policy of regime change. And so I think the most important thing the U.S. could do is signal, just as it's done in North Korea, that the whole point of this is not to change your regime. It's not to attack you. It's to get you to give up these capabilities and to get you on a road to be integrated into the international community. And it's going to be a costly road for Iran. But nonetheless, the United States isn't, through all of this, standing back and saying, whatever happens, we're going to try to bring you down. And so far, the United States has not been willing to move away from that. And I don't know all the inner deliberations of the administration. What I hear is that it's the typical thing. The hardliners in Cheney's office, including Cheney himself, I'm told, although I don't know for sure, and the hardliners in the Pentagon just will not settle into a policy where if Iran makes all these significant concessions that the Europeans are demanding, that the United States would offer Iran some kind of security guarantee and some kind of assurance that it won't try to actively work to change the regime.
What do you think the odds are that the United States will intervene militarily in Iran?
Well, I don't think it's very high. I mean, I think there's been some recent reports where some have said, you know, it's almost certain. I don't think so. I mean, the problem for the United States is that the Iranian nuclear program is very diffuse. I mean, it's at a lot of different sites. Gas centrifuges are very mobile. I think that's one of the problems that they confront us with, is that they're easy to hide. They don't need a lot of electricity. There's no clear signatures when you look from outside with satellite surveillance or just look at a building. You can be even close to it and not know it's a gas centrifuge plant. And so, what do you bomb? And the concern is that, yes, the program could be set back by a bombing campaign, but it may not be that much. And it may make the Iranians so mad that they may do other things by pouring in resources in particular to actually accelerate the program and make more centrifuges faster than they would have if they just ended the suspension. The other part of it is that it's not going to be a single strike like what Israel did in 1981 at the Osirk reactor. It's going to be a multi-day bombing campaign, at least. And that's, in essence, declaring war. And I don't believe that if we did that, that Iran is just going to sit back and say, there's nothing we can do. I think that they could make our life miserable in Iraq. They could launch terrorist strikes various places. They could do all kinds of things where it'd be very hard for the United States to then decide to invade Iran. I mean, they're not going to get the British to go along. And the United States, in any case, can't invade Iran and hope to occupy it, particularly as this crisis develops, you can just see the nationalism growing in Iran. I mean, most people in Iran now want nuclear weapons. And they're angry that the United States is trying to deny them these weapons. So the United States and the Bush administration is well aware of these considerations. And so I think people who talk lightly about military strikes, I think, are doing us all a disservice because it's a very different kind of country than Iraq. And if we attack, we are going to war. And I don't think we're in any way prepared to do that. And I think most Americans would be very opposed to such activity.
When you look around the world, both at countries and also at terrorist groups, whose possible use of nuclear weapons worries you the most?
Well, for the long term, certainly terrorist use of nuclear weapons worries me the most. I mean, finally, Iran and North Korea are rational actors.
North Korea? A lot of people would say that North Korea is not rational.
No, I think they're rational. I think we don't necessarily always understand their thinking, and it's often very extremist and somewhat hysterical in nature. But I think they're rational. They want to survive. They want to economically grow. They want to use their nuclear weapons capabilities to get benefits. They want to avoid a confrontation where they're eliminated. And unfortunately, I don't see the terrorists in that category. I mean, I don't necessarily see if a terrorist group gets a nuclear weapon, they rush to detonate it here. They may do something else with it. They may seek to use it to blackmail or gain leverage over a country. I mean, we just don't know. But I think that the irrationality that I fear of the terrorists is that you can't negotiate with them, that they have an agenda, and they're going to live out that agenda regardless of what we can offer them or threaten them with. I worry that most of all, that if they do get a nuclear weapon and they decide to detonate it in our country, that so many will die and our social system may never be the same. I mean, we may not have a democracy after such an event. And I don't know what we'll do in response. Unleashing American anger could be devastating around the world, given our military power. And so I do, in the end, worry most about a nuclear strike here.
You're an expert on nuclear weapons development around the world and attempts to prevent that from happening. Is most of your research done through reading information, or do you actually do some, undercover detective work, or going around the world and investigating these covert networks?
Well, we do. What we would reading to us would be open source information. I mean, we spend a lot of time collecting information from the media, other places, written products, TV, to get information. Journalists are very good detectives. And their work is, believe me, is looked at by groups like ours, but also intelligence agencies. We also, for over a decade, have had a policy of hiring people from inside programs, Iraqi program, South African program, others that we will work with to try to understand what they've done or what others could do. And as part of that, we seek out Iranians who have inside knowledge of the program. We also use satellite imagery to look at facilities in Iran, North Korea. We don't do anything undercover, but we do other things in order to build up information through working with companies and individuals who may have access. So basically, we use all sources that we can to try to answer the questions about these secret programs.
Well, when you hire a former nuclear insider from a country like Iran or Iraq, how do you know that what they're telling you is the truth? How do you know that they're not still a part of that network and they're just trying to give you misinformation to misdirect you and American intelligence experts?
Well, you always worry about that. I mean, in some cases, I may have known the person beforehand. But I'll give you a case. We hired an Iraqi in the 1990s who came to us. I knew his debriefing. He defected from Iraq. A guy named Kadir Hamza. I knew him quite well prior to when he called me to set up a contact. The irony there was that while he was a valuable source to us and worked with us very productively for about a year or two, the misinformation he got into after he left ISIS was spinning up the Iraqi nuclear threat. I mean, he was always on TV, wrote a book, exaggerating wildly Iraqi nuclear threats. And we knew he was exaggerating, and we knew he was even contradicting many of the things he told us. But there was no way we could get that message out effectively, even though we tried.
What do you think was Kadir Hamza's motive in hyping the Iraqi nuclear program?
I think in the end it was a deep hatred of Saddam and a desire to have the regime changed. And I also think he needed the money. I mean,
Are you saying he was paid to hype the program?
I think, he was definitely paid while he hyped the program. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Paid by who?
And he was paid in some sense to give speeches at universities. Some media people paid him. I don't know what he received from Chalabi's organization, but I wouldn't be surprised if they paid him. I mean, he was a very important ally of Chalabi during 2002, 2003.
So you're just saying, like, the more dramatic the story he could tell, the more likely he'd be asked to speak for a fee or whatever.
Yeah, and the media was, you know, was not very aggressive in challenging his statements.
Finally, just a kind of personal question about, you know, nuclear terror. For a lot of people who grew up in the 50s, they were just, you know, it just kind of pounded into you that, you know, China and Russia, those were China and the Soviet Union, those were like the nuclear powers. Those were the countries that might drop the bomb. And if the bomb dropped, you know, that was going to be the end. Or, you know, you needed a bomb shelter. You were hiding under your desk in school in case of nuclear attack, that whole thing. And so I think, like, at least one generation grew up with just nightmares of this nuclear holocaust that would be initiated by China or Russia. Now, after the Cold War, the whole nuclear nightmare scenario changed. And now it's more, you know, countries that Iran, North Korea, or terrorist groups. And I'm wondering, like, which nuclear age did you come up in? And are you kind of hardwired with any specific nuclear fear scenario? And I don't mean your rational side. I mean, like, the side that comes, that surfaces when you're dreaming at night and you just have your average nightmare.
Oh, no, I grew up in the 50s and early 60s. And the horror continued into the 60s. I mean, I can remember a BBC documentary. Actually, was banned in Britain on what would happen if Britain was attacked by nuclear weapons, and it became kind of a cult film in the 60s. So, and certainly can remember sort of nuclear exercises in when I was in grade school. So, but you know, it was there. It was kind of it grew into kind of a fear of kind of sort of the end of humankind. I mean, the end of civilization. I mean, just massive damage. I mean, limited nuclear war was just 20 million people dying all at once in America. But there was confidence that I felt as a kid. I mean, increasing confidence. Maybe it was irrational if you think of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But nonetheless, I think it grew in the 60s and into the 70s. Chance of a nuclear war was very small. You know, it was catastrophic for the world if it happened. But it was a small risk because the nations were managing this and our leaders were managing this. What I fear now and fear for my child is that you can't manage it in the end, that you're fighting a battle to keep that one nuclear weapon or a couple nuclear weapons from going off on American cities, and you can't quite get on top of it. So that's my nightmare, is that we're trying to stop particularly a nuclear terrorist attack on America, but we can't quite get on top of it, and it's getting easier as the years click by for terrorists to build nuclear weapons because the technology is spreading. You know, maybe they'll finally succeed in stealing some. I mean, people steal from the strongest banks sometimes. And so ultimately my nightmare is that my child is inheriting a world where they won't feel secure. And that, to me, it would be a horrible tragedy.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
David Albright is the president of the Institute for Science and International Security.